agenda, let me announce those for you now. From what I understand, House Bill 2247 will be taken off. We will start first with Senate Bill 262A, because we started a public hearing on that last week, or at the last meeting. House Bills 235, 236, 239 will be on for public hearing only. So with those changes, I will open the public hearing on Senate Bill 262A and ask counsel to explain that for us.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Senate Bill 262A comes to you from the Oregon Health Sciences University. This is a measure that would extend the sunset for an exemption to the public records statute for records identifying persons engaged in animal research at OHSU. We heard on Monday from the provost of OHSU, Dr. Leslie Halleck, that the measure is offered to protect the name, home address, and location of persons who are engaged in or providing services for medical research on animals other than rodents at OHSU, this exemption is currently set to expire in January of 2006, and that the measure before you will permit it to continue until January 2010. There is a change to the exemption that's currently present by virtue of an amendment on the Senate side, and this amendment to the bill expressly makes clear that the exemption does not apply to information contained in OHSU press releases, websites, or other publications circulated to the general public.
Thank you. We have two witnesses, Jim Newman, Andrea Meyer. Would you like to come forward, please? And Mr. Newman, since you're a proponent, you may proceed first.
Yes, Chairman Ackerman and the rest of the committee, my name is Jim Newman. I am in the communications office at Oregon Health and Science University, and I also handle communications for the Oregon National Primate Research Center. Specifically, I also handle communications regarding animal research and animal activity. As you heard earlier this week from our provost, Leslie Halleck, we have had a number of incidents of harassment and other activity, some bordering on illegal, related to activists' access to names and information about OHSU, and that's why we think that further limiting this information is important in some cases. I wanted to bring to light a couple of things that have happened in the last week or so. Most recently, a document which I just provided to you, which is titled The Animal Liberation Front Raids Future Primate Facility. And what this is the details of a raid on a proposed facility on the East Coast. And what's important about this is a local posting on a local website. And comments following this story suggest that OHSU should be targeted in the same way. And when I say targeted in the same way, the damage at this facility included pouring paint stripper on vehicles, destroying expensive plants, spray painting comments, including the ALF is watching, and this is just the start. Another person who posted a comment following the story suggests that a specific business that OHSU works with be targeted. It's a business that provides caging, or I should say modifies caging for our primate center, making the cages bigger. It also provides play structures for the animals. The name of this company was listed at the website, the name of the president of the company's address, and the home number for purposes of a harassment. Two other things that I wanted to draw to your attention were also included in the packet that we provided to you earlier this week, and one of them is titled Cursed Animal Activists Ruin My Evening, and this is the play-by-play of a harassment that occurred on the night of May 26, and it details the message itself is posted by somebody posing as a researcher. It was not posted by the researcher themselves. And the posting has some very menacing comments in it. One of them suggests that the next time this person is harassed, that the activists bring bricks. Another person lists the researcher's home number, repeats his address, and also gives his wife's name, and provides other personal details about that researcher. The following quotes were also left at this website, suggesting, OHSU researchers, you can't hide. We're watching you. Better lock your doors. Better shut your gate. Well, if you do, we'll just climb over it, and we'll do it again and again and again. Another important comment from this website suggests that other activists form their own cells and carry out their own actions. The message also mentions that a second researcher was harassed that very same night. And I should point out that researcher hasn't worked at OHSU for a number of years. Or I should say, OHSU's Primate Center for a number of years. The final thing I would like to provide to you is another posting from a local website called Another Night of OHSU Researcher Residential Fun. And this was posted on the internet on June 1st, and it details the harassment of three more OHSU researchers on May 31st. This time, the person who posted the message poses as a police officer. It was not a police officer who posted the message. It details how activists went to the door to harass one of our researchers and her family face-to-face during a graduation party for her daughter. It also indicates the goal of the protesters to frighten the researcher, her daughter, and her daughter's friends. And again, follow-up messages on this website list the researcher's home address, again promoting the idea that other activists should harass these researchers at their homes. And that's pretty much the conclusion of my comments. I think that Leslie Halleck also explained the history of this, the use of this bill, or I should say the former bill, and how we've been keeping track of our use of it. And I'm open to any questions you may have.
We'll take those after Ms. Myers to testify.
Good morning, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. You know, Oregon has a strong and enduring policy that public records and government activities be open to the public. And the guiding principle in Oregon is to protect the public's right to inspect public records. Disclosure is the rule. It is irrelevant who the person is seeking the public records generally. And as the Attorney General Manual states, quote, interested persons, news media representatives, business people seeking access for personal gain, busybodies on fishing expeditions, persons seeking to embarrass government agencies, and scientific researchers all stand on equal footing. The ACLU of Oregon opposes Senate Bill 2662A engrossed, which extends the sunset on the amendments to ORS 192.501, part of our public records laws. It carves out a sweeping exception to Oregon's public records laws regarding animal research activities in Oregon Health Sciences universities. We oppose the special treatment on a number of grounds. Now I want to be clear. The problems and the events that were articulated by the proponents of this bill are real. They're harassment. They're criminal. But this isn't the solution to that problem. And I think that's partly reflected by the testimony today. This bill was passed 2 years ago. This has been the law. You're not hearing today that this has solved the problem, that this is indeed the protective safety guards that are needed to ensure that the activities articulated by the proponents is stopped. It isn't. First, I want to make clear Oregon law has already protected the home addresses and personal telephone numbers of threatened individuals. OHSU seeks to remove from public records the name, home address, professional address, or location of a person that is engaged in or that provides goods or services for medical research at OHSU that is conducted using animals other than rodents. But this law is not necessary because ORS 192.445 allows any person to have their home address and telephone number removed from the public records for public safety reasons. As such, there's no reason to do this here today for the reasons that you've mostly heard articulated, the home address and the personal information of these folks. OHSU currently puts the names, photographs, and information about research activities of its animal researchers up on its website. At the same time that OHSU is asking you to allow it to make public records on its researchers top secret, it continues to provide information about its own researchers on its websites, including individual photographs, allowing people not only to identify the research activities, but the researchers themselves. And I have verified yet again that this is still happening on the OHSU website. This appears to us to be one of the most disingenuous aspects of this proposal. OHSU has stated that it needs to provide special security for researchers engaged in animal research. However, before, as well as after this law, the OHSU continues to put their own researchers at risk by posting their photographs on the web. If the true purpose of this legislation were to deal solely with safety of researchers, OHSU would not be taking steps at the same time it asks for special treatment to expose the researchers to safety risks. OHSU is prohibiting access to public record documents to organizations that oppose OHSU's policies. Indeed, the real reason that OHSU is seeking this law is to be able to pick and choose who receives public records, because OHSU does not like what some folks say. Legislators seek public records from various state agencies. Imagine if the agency were to deny production because the legislator intended to take to the House floor to bring public attention to abuses or hold a press conference to alert Oregonians of your concerns. That wouldn't be tolerated. OHSU is a public entity and as such must comply with the Oregon Public Records Law. It cannot pick and choose between favorable versus unfavorable press. Yet that's exactly what they've been doing, and they've documented. Examining the tracking report, which was provided to you on Monday by the proponents, OHSU reports that it has denied access to groups such as PETA because, and I quote, in the past, PETA has spread damaging but false information about OHSU animal care, unquote. Public bodies cannot deny or approve public record requests based on the opinions expressed by the requester. However, with this law, OHSU is engaging in selective disclosure and are withholding records having nothing to do with protecting the safety and security of its employees. It testified on Monday that we've given every request to the press. The press is just one component of the public. It is not the only entity that has the right to ask for records to understand, expose, discuss, and educate our communities on what it's doing. While there may be some organizations, there are some organizations out there who have intentions directed towards violence and criminal activities, likewise there are other animal advocacy organizations that engage in lawful activity but have also had barriers put up from obtaining this information because OHSU wants to pick and choose. They don't like what they're saying. Investigative reporting by local media previously has identified abuse of OHSU research monkeys, and I've attached some information on pages 2, 3, and 4 of my testimony. Why is having detailed information so important? Only having the name of the researcher whose monkeys were self-mutilating was a reporter able to track down and report to the public in 2001 the serious animal abuses that occurred at OHSU. As a result of the information coming to light, changes were made to the treatment of those animals. OHSU wants the authority to redact names of researchers from the public record, but if there's an allegation of animal abuse, the reporter would likely never be able to locate the information because it would require the reporters to sort through thousands of records for a needle in a haystack. There are thousands of animals with research activities directed at them, but if a researcher comes from another jurisdiction, they want to be able to track that researcher and their activities if that researcher has a history of abuse that we as Oregonians don't even know about. Watchdog groups also exposed the fact that OHSU was buying dogs and cats from an animal shelter. If this law had been in effect earlier, the public might never have learned that the Clackamas County Animal Shelter was selling dogs and cats to OHSU for research. By removing the names of those who provide goods and services to OHSU researchers, it might be impossible to uncover similar practices in the future. Senate Bill 262 continues an overbroad special interest exception to our Oregon public records laws. And for all these reasons, the ACLU of Oregon urges you not to move forward with this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. I want to direct a question to legal counsel, Senator Ms. Meyer raised a legal point. The Senate bill relates to ORS 192.501 as the exemption for these names and addresses. Ms. Meyer cites 192.445 as stating that this is already covered under that statute. Counsel, is there a distinction between the two statutes?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I believe there is. The statute cited by Ms. Meyer, 192.445, for the proposition that a person may already have their home address removed from public records requests. It is accurate, but there's detail to it that the law states that an individual may submit a written request to a public body not to have that information disclosed, but it's not an automatic thing. The statute goes on to say that a public body may, and I'm reading out of 192.445, 3.445 sub 1 for the record. A public body may not disclose the specified public record if the individual demonstrates to the satisfaction of the public body that the personal safety of the individual or personal safety of a family member residing with the individual is in danger if the home address, personal telephone number, or electronic mail address remains available for public inspection. The statute then goes on to direct the Attorney General to adopt rules that spell out what sort of written request would be required and what sort of showing for personal safety would be required. And statute spells out a non-exclusive list, such as showing that a person has been the victim of domestic violence, showing that the person has obtained a restraining order, stalking order, showing that the person has suffered from physical abuse, obtained a temporary restraining order, or other no-contact order because of physical abuse, filed criminal or legal proceedings regarding physical protection, and so on. And that if the public body deems that the records shall not be, because of the reasons stated, disclosed, there's also a time limit under the statute that if the person does not submit a written request, essentially rescinding their request not to disclose the information, that time period is 5 years, after which the public body is no longer required to redact that information unless the person asks again.
Thank you, counsel. So, okay, we conclude that the Senate Bill 262 provides broader coverage and a more effective mechanism.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, I think that's accurate because under the proposed change, well, I shouldn't say the current statute, which the sunset of which would be extended under Senate Bill 262, the employee of the agency would not have to go through that process of making the request and making the showing that would be required under 192.445 and would not have to worry about rescinding the request later or asking for the request to be renewed in 5 years. I'd also say that it even goes further because it not only applies to the researchers employed by OHSU, but it also applies to individuals providing goods or services to OHSU, which the statute cited does not appear on its face to apply to anyway.
Thank you again. Are there questions from the committee to the panel? Representative Garrard?
Yeah. Ms. Myers indicated that you have a website that displays a lot of the same personal information. Can you respond to that?
Certainly. Chairman Ackerman and Representative Garrard, the information contained at the website is overviews of the research, and it does contain some pictures of some of our researchers. Of course, we'll leave it up to them as to whether they want to have a picture there. The information that this bill covered is very different in that activists who are looking for information are looking for very detailed information about studies, the specific protocols involving animals, and also various descriptions of medications animals are being given, if they're being treated with any sort of surgery or anything like that. That's the kind of information that activists are looking for, because that information is taken out of context and then attached to that researcher's name. And I think it's important to state that what we're not trying to do, we're not trying to say that certain groups can't have any information at all about our research. In fact, all we're trying to take out is the connection between the researcher and a piece of information, so that somebody cannot demonize a researcher by taking that information out of context, placing it on a website, and encouraging the harassment or illegal acts against that person. Again, it's the connection to the name and not all of the details of the research that we're trying to limit.
Chair Ackerman, Representative Gerard, I would submit that type of activity will occur and will always occur and has occurred. But what gets left out and who it makes it hard to get the information from is those organizations who are trying to educate and bring forward information about research activities. They're going through the legal process. They're trying to obtain accurate information. And those groups that want to spread absolute lies can do so. We look at this sheet and we see that the media gets the researchers' names, but that they've refused on almost, if not every occasion, anyone other than media for information connecting the name with the animals. So there's clearly a line, and this is an exemption or exception which allows OHSU to make the determination about whether they will give the information. And their track record is they're picking and choosing based on what you're going to say. These organizations are not all documented as having criminal or illegal activity, but they're still being denied.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
This question is for Mr. Newman. During the testimony that Ms. Myers was sharing, and I've just kind of jotted down some notes here, law allowing OHSU to pick and choose disclosures. Do you have a policy right now that kind of dictates what you do with that?
Yes, we do. There is a review policy for every inquiry that comes in. Of course, if it's we don't do that with every single media member. If somebody we work with the media very regularly, we understand exactly what they're looking for. We expedite that. We run that through as quickly as possible. However, there is a process that involves myself and our provost and our vice president for research and, of course, legal to go through this and ensure that this is being done in a fair manner. And there's lots of discussion that occurs before we make any move in regards to using this law.
Chair Ackerman, Representative Olson, you'll see in my testimony a letter dated May 19, 2003 from Willamette Week. This was even prior to this law. Paragraph 3, in our extensive reporting, Mr. Schrag wrote, on OHSU's primate research, we found that almost every request for public records was met with delay and denial. On several occasions, we found it necessary to involve our lawyer in the process to get what were clearly public records. And the reasons for the resistance became obvious. They were the ones who exposed some of the documented animal research abuses going on. And this is media having obstacles and unfortunately having the resources of attorneys. I know In Defense of Animals has been in extensive litigation over getting records from OHSU and recently won a Court of Appeals case to remand it back for a determination. They set up a huge financial obstacle. So it's the fox guarding the hen house to some degree, and we simply need to have some assurances that they can't do what they're doing, and this provides further opportunities for them to go beyond the scope of the protections that their employees should have.
Further,
I just remind the committee that I think the amendment only refers to providing an exemption for the name, home address, and professional addresses of persons engaged in the research with the OHSU, not its work product as such. And there is something in the file, there's a big grid in there that I think contained all of the requests and all the responses from the OHSU under the Public Records Act. And just, if you haven't read that, I want to let you know that that is in there already.
Okay.
And we're not talking about work product, we're talking about names and addresses of people that, in my opinion, have been harassed and menaced, okay? And I think the question is whether they're entitled to this protection. Representative Olson, did you want to?
No, I'm done. Thank you, Mr.
Chair Ackerman. I want to be clear. I mean, the ACLU does not have a problem with the addresses and home contact information. It's the name. It's the name of the researcher. If you get a hold of records of, and there's thousands of primates up there, and if you're trying to wheedle down and understand, and you get records of a pattern that appears to be going on, it's important to get the name of the researcher. That researcher may have had past practices in other jurisdictions that raise some alarms and questions. We need to track and understand who's doing the research and what are they bringing to that. In this type of activity, in public entities engaging in activities, you want to know who's doing it. We do not oppose inclusion of the home address and telephone number, but I just want to be clear that that really needs to be separated. When we talk about name, we are talking about very important information. And again, their pictures and their names are up on the website. It's linking that particular research with activity, good activity or potentially bad activity. And it's that important link that the community needs the opportunity for information and education on if there's something going on.
Okay, further questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Meyer, you indicated twice in your testimony that OHSU opposes what some people say and that they don't like what animal rights organizations are saying. I would ask you, for instance, Animal Liberation Front and some of the documented cases of personal threat and harassment That goes beyond saying, wouldn't you agree?
Oh, Chair Ackerman, Representative Flores, I'm speaking of the sheet that they provided where any entity beyond the media, including PETA, where they put down additional details. They wrote down on their own tracking sheet the concerns or reasons that they appeared. They don't. They say it's additional details, so they don't link it with this is why. But they refer to PETA as they denied the requested. Their request, they redacted the names in this case, as opposed to media where they didn't redact the names. So they used their new authority under this law to deny this organization, and their only notes explaining it were, in the past, PETA has spread damaging but false information about OHSU animal care. Not that PETA has engaged in criminal activity and we have safety concerns based on very past acts of that that person or entity requesting that. That's what's alarming to us, is that link between some redaction going on to the requesting party and that notation about. I mean, I'm glad they did it. It makes it clear what their thinking is. And again, when this sunset, we might come forward a few years from now, and that may not be on there anymore. But it, to me, kind of raised quite an alarm as to the reality of what's going on in the practice.
Further questions, Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To both the panelists. Now, do I understand correctly, then, that on the website, the names of the researchers are posted, just not contact information?
Correct. Their names are posted. In some cases, their pictures. Their locations are never posted. We do not post where they are. It's the West Campus, where our Primate Center is approximately 20 to 25 buildings. It's a very large facility. So if we just say that they're there, nobody knows which lab specifically to target if they're meaning to do illegal acts. Their locations are not there. Of course, their home addresses aren't there. There are a couple comments I would love to respond to, and also perhaps we should have our provost come up if there's additional questions, because she's also heavily involved in this, if that's appropriate, Chair.
Well, let's get your questions, because we're going to have to. This is the first bill up today, and
sure.
You know our time limits. And as I said 2 days ago, the longer we stay in this room, the less chance is that these bills are going to get either to the full committee or to the floor of the House or the Senate.
Yes, Chair. Thank you very much. The couple of comments I just wanted to respond with is that a couple of times we've heard testimony that OHSU had been doing some things with animals, had been found guilty of animal abuse, and that's just not true. In fact, the USDA did a two-month investigation of our Primate Center following those allegations, and we were cleared, and I have a number of articles from the Oregonian and from other local news organizations claiming OHSU clears Primate Center. Here's the Oregonian saying OHSU clears Primate Center. Our record is very clean, and I think that some false allegations by a member of PETA, I should note, who made the false allegations this was all based on, was found to be completely lying. Unfortunately, the publication that was mentioned Willamette Week went ahead and printed his allegations before we were cleared.
Let me just make couple of concluding statements before we take this into work session, if that's where the committee wants to go. The fact that the exemption would apply to the persons and their locations doesn't mean that it cannot otherwise be disclosed, because under 192.501 these records are exempt unless the public interest requires disclosure, and there is a process to make that determination through the Attorney General's office and then on to Circuit Court if the records are not forthcoming. And should the applicant or the petitioner receive an order of disclosure from a court, then they're also awarded attorney's fees. So there's a very viable remedy here that you may not know, but I think does provide some incentive for the agency to produce records. Otherwise, the court makes the call. So they're not exempt forever and ever, okay, as I understand the law. Are there further questions from the committee to the panel? Okay, are there any further witnesses on Senate Bill 262A? Hearing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 262A and open a work session on Senate Bill 262A. The chair would move that Senate Bill 262A be forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? I just want to say that I think that the behavior that's been exhibited against these employees is outrageous, menacing, has no element of free speech in it, in my mind, and that's why I was motivated to sponsor the bill for approval by the full committee. Further discussion from the committee? Seeing none, then the clerk may call the roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Garrard?
No.
Representative Worth excused? Mr. Chair?
Absent.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. What was the vote count, please?
Two ayes, one nay, one absent.
I don't think we can forward it to the committee unless we have three affirmative. Is that correct, counsel?
That's correct.
Okay, so what's the disposition as far as, you just conclude the work session?
Yes.
President Garrard?
Mr. Chair, if you'd like to, I would give a courtesy vote to the chair.
Your vote this from no to yes?
Yes.
Thank you. Then with that, the Senate Bill 262A will be forwarded to the full committee. And now the motion was with a due pass recommendation. Do you still want to
do that? I'm fine with that.
You're still fine with that?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I understand your vote's a courtesy vote, and I appreciate that. So it's forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and the work session of Senate Bill 262 is concluded. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 229A. Counsel?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 229A comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. This bill requires a court in a dependency proceeding to give preference to the placement of a child to a person with caregiver relationship with a caregiver relationship with the child. This bill also clarifies the definition of caregiver relationship for placement as well as intervener status. This bill also sets forth the process for substitution of appointed counsel in termination of parental rights cases that allows a court to only substitute appointed counsel for a party pursuant to the rules adopted by the Public Defense Service Commission concerning appointed counsel.
I think Wendy Johnson was the only witness I had on the witness list. I thought I saw her earlier this morning. Is she here?
She's here. Let me check in the hall for you.
Okay. I did see her. I just assumed she'll be coming back. All right, then I will temporarily adjourn the public hearing on Senate Bill 229A. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think Jerry Watson is here from the Oregon Law Commission.
Would you be prepared on this bill?
I am not prepared on this bill, but Wendy Johnson has, I believe, the next five bills on your list. I have only 20.
Okay, well, I'll open a public hearing then on 920 so we can keep the show rolling, okay? Council, Senate Bill 920.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 920A also comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. This bill revises Oregon's laws relating to execution sales. Specifically, it describes what a writ of execution may direct the sheriff to do, sets out rules regarding the issuance and return of a writ, and makes several other changes to those provisions, to those laws. These Oregon execution and redemption laws are over 100 years old, and this bill represents the first time they've been comprehensively overhauled. Also, you have before you Dash A4 amendments. These amendments make mostly technical changes, and Mr. Watson will go into further detail on those amendments.
Is there anyone else that's here to testify on this bill?
David Hendricks should be here if he could be. He's supposedly watching or listening and
okay.
Intends to be here. And Mark Comstock is here. And if
we'll,
you want
we'll,
him to
we'll
come
see
up,
what,
he could.
What develops, Mr. Watson. You are the only witness. I assume you're for the proposal. You may proceed.
Yes, sir.
I'd like you all to keep in mind our time deadlines. We have to be in house on the House floor at 10:45, okay. And we have several bills yet to go. So this, keep that in mind for
us, please. I'll try to proceed expeditiously. Chair Ackerman, okay. Members of the committee, you've heard a summary of the bill. Senate Bill 920 does make substantial revisions to Oregon's law relating to execution sales. That is when someone, basically on the basis of a judgment, takes possession of property and then the procedure for disposing of it and moving it to sale. Many of those provisions are old. They've been amended frequently over the years. The amendments are less than crystal clear. The Oregon Law Commission, in its ordinary process, creates work groups. In this case, a work group called a sub-work group was created under the judgments work group to deal specifically with the topic of judicial sales, which is what we're talking about here. That group met throughout. Was very broadly representative of debtor-creditors, the Department of Justice, Judicial Department, and basically the every affected interest, met throughout 2004 and 2005, and prepared this bill for your consideration. So what you see before you is the consensus result of that process. You also have what I believe are dash four amendments, and they are primarily technical in character. I have a report which I've distributed to the members of the committee, and I can have the extra copies available. This report is a summary. It's somewhat shorter than we might ordinarily do in our formal report process, but it goes through the document, and I will not attempt to do that in detail, but if you have questions with regard to that, I'll be happy to go over them. The bill received overwhelming approval in the Senate and is before you. As to the amendments that you've brought, let me just give you a couple of examples of how those amendments worked out. For example, on the first page of the amendments, it talks about at page 2, line 24, after the word debtor, insert to be levied on. Very minor change to clarify that the property is to be levied on where the judgment debtor is located. Another example, the very next one, line 37, provides for the sheriff to record a copy of the notice of the levy when they're levying in an adjacent county to give notice in a way that's not available otherwise. Those were largely cleanups of the reworking that already happened in the text of the basic bill. Much of what you see in the amendments, the larger parts of it, are there in the sense of cut and paste. They took out a large section, put in a large section. With regard to section 29, for example, starting on page 4 of your dash 4 amendments, the manner of payment is really there to take out the word that was in the original bill on teller checks, and the decision was made that teller checks were not appropriate for use in this context, so the change, while it's fairly lengthy, is to simply remove three or four references to teller checks. With that, I'd be happy to answer questions or turn it over to Mr. Comstock or Mr. Hendricks if he arrives at your choice. Representative Ackerman.
Do you have any comments you'd like to make?
Thank you, Chair Ackerman and members of the committee. My name is Mark Comstock. I'm an attorney in private practice. A lot of my practice is in the area of debtor-creditor. I've been a member of this work group and also the judgment work group as part of the commission's work. I wanted to just address that briefly a little bit of the work group's work, and that it was certainly broadly based, representative of the court, and more importantly, we had representatives of the sheriffs who actually are the ones that go through the procedure. And a lot of what you see in the dash four amendments and in the bill is to make sure that the sheriffs are treating executions in the various counties in a similar way. We've had problems where we might have an execution sale in County A that goes under one procedure, yet when we have an execution sale in County B, the sheriff would not accept a cashier's check in payment, and that puts a, shall we say, a crimp in the procedure. And we also had representatives that looked after debtors' interests here to make sure that there was proper notice and to bring forward the efforts to make sure that if there is to be an execution sale, it is for the best price that is available, because that looks after the debtor's interests and certainly looks after the creditor's interests. So I just want to urge the committee to adopt the Dash 4 amendments and vote the bill as amended out to the floor with a do pass recommendation. We believe that it's long since time for this area of law to be clarified, so there is a uniform procedure that both sheriffs and creditors and debtors can follow, and recognizes some changes in how society works, especially in how publication is made and how sales occur. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Seeing none, looks like you've done your job well, or else we haven't read the bill. Sometimes we have to take the law commission on good faith. It's a tough read. Thank you very much, and I'll conclude the public hearing on Senate Bill 920A, and open a work session on Senate Bill 920A. The chair will move that the Dash 4 amendments be incorporated within the main bill. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, that's allowed. The chair will move that Senate Bill 920A be forwarded to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion from the committee. Seeing none, the clerk may call a roll.
Representative Flores?
Aye.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Flores absent. Chair Ackerman?
Aye. Okay. Senate Bill 920A is forwarded to the full committee with a do-pass recommendation, and I will carry the bill to the full committee. With that, the work session on that bill is concluded. Are we ready on Senate Bill 229A? Is Ms. Johnson back? Okay. I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 229A. Council?
Again, Senate Bill 229A comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission. This bill requires a court in dependency proceeding to give preference to the placement of a child to a person with caregiver, a caregiver relationship to the child, and it clarifies that definition. It also sets forth the process for the substitution of appointed counsel in termination of parental right cases. It allows the court to substitute appointed counsel for a party pursuant to the rules adopted by the Public Defense Service Commission concerning appointed counsel.
Want to come forward, Ms. Johnson, please. You're the only witness, and I'm sure you're the proponent of the bill, so welcome to the committee, and keep in mind our timelines, please.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. My name is Wendy Johnson, for the record, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. You should have before you a report from the Law Commission describing Senate Bill 229. This bill is actually the simplest bill I think the Law Commission has this session. We had made a reference mistake last session when we overhauled a bunch of other chapters, and so the main reason for the bill was to reference the correct statute rather than a repealed statute, and then there was a term that had been used incorrectly. Over on the Senate side, an amendment was made that was a friendly amendment regarding the substituted counsel, and your counsel has described that amendment. As you said, it's unopposed. It's a cleanup bill that received a very favorable floor vote in the Senate, and we just recommend your due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. Are there questions from the committee?
Okay, hearing none, you're excused, and thank you very much for your presentation. Are there any further witnesses on Senate Bill 229A who would like to testify this morning? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 229A. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 229A, and I leave that work session open because we do not have a quorum to proceed at this point, but when Ms. Flores comes back or Ms. Worth comes back, I think we'll have a quorum. So just hold that open. I will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 235A. We will not proceed to a work session on this bill this morning. Do we have anybody here on Senate Bill 235? I have people signed up for that. Please come forward. Yeah, go ahead. Counsel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 235A comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, requires a place of public accommodation to remove physical barriers to entering and using the existing facilities if removal is readily achievable, provides auxiliary aids and services to disabled personnel necessary to ensure equal access to good services and facilities, removes physical administrative barriers if removal barrier is readily achievable, requires a place of public accommodation to take alternative steps, removal is not readily achievable. Chair, members of the committee, if I remember correctly, this bill is intended to follow and be similar to federal law.
Okay, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. I want to make sure before I get too far into my testimony to make sure you have the right documents before you, because this is one of our more complicated bills today. You should have just a couple of pages of Boley's administrative rules in this area. Then you should also have a copy of federal laws in this area. It says federal laws at the top. And then there's a law commission report that says Civil Rights Work Group, Senate Bill 235. So there's a report. There's also testimony from Marsha Olermiller that was submitted earlier. And there's a dash A3 amendment. So those are the materials I'll be speaking from. Let me back up and explain why the law commission has this bill before you, because it has become a bit of a political bill this session for unbeknown reasons to me. But what this bill did, or why it came about, was the law commission did a reorganization of the civil rights statutes two sessions ago. When they did that reorganization to put all the civil rights statutes into one chapter, there were problems that were noted. One of the problems was this statute that is at issue in this bill has been interpreted by the federal courts. It hasn't been interpreted by the state courts, but federal courts have found it to be less protective than federal law. Oregon, when it originally had its disability discrimination laws, actually was ahead of the time and enacted its prohibition on discrimination against disabled persons before the ADA even passed. So Oregon has been progressive in recognizing the needs of the disabled. Unfortunately, the federal courts have interpreted Oregon statute to be less protective than federal law. There's what I would call active discrimination and discrimination based on inaction. The federal courts have found that Oregon's law only prohibits overt discrimination or active discrimination. For example, you can't come in here because you're disabled. And so that doesn't get you very far in protecting the disabled. Federal law, as you know, requires an accommodation, requires helping the disabled person in the door, providing a ramp in some circumstances, reaching above the shelf to hand the disabled person something. And so, unfortunately, the federal courts, in a number of opinions, usually in the area of big stadiums and such, in large litigation cases, have said that the state statute is not very protective and it only prohibits that active discrimination. So this bill adds in a couple of lines regarding the requirement to also accommodate the disabled persons. And the language is taken from federal law, both the CFRs and the United States Code. And so that's where the language in the bill comes from. Boley already has administrative rules in this area because as I said at the beginning, Oregon has been ahead of the game in terms of providing accommodations requiring no discrimination against disabled, including accommodations. Boley's had these rules for a long time. And as I said, the state courts have not interpreted, so our state courts may rule against the interpretation that the federal court has. So they've had these rules regarding reasonable accommodations, requiring places of public accommodations to provide accommodation. And so the bill puts the Bollier administrative rules in what many of us thought would require instead. So that's what you have before you. In writing the bill, there was a struggle between very descriptive versus general in how to write it, because there's already federal law in this area, and so state and federal law is both at play. And so because federal law keeps changing in this area, the work group that worked on this area decided that it would be best to keep Oregon state statute general and relying on the federal law to develop, so that businesses did not have to try to meet two standards. So you see very little definition in this bill for that reason. Instead, there is a direct reference in the bill to require Bollier, when it's writing its administrative rules, to look to federal law on how to make the definitions. The amendment before you, though, would take out that administrative rule reference that restricts Bollier in their administrative rules. It is not recommended by the Law Commission, that -A3 amendment. We made that amendment request to satisfy the desire of some of the senators who were opposed to the bill. Senator Beyer in the Judiciary Committee voted against this bill and said he would vote for the bill if we took out the amendments that we made. Those amendments took out definitions and put in the administrative rule requirement to follow federal law. So if you adopt the amendments, you would be taking out that administrative rule restriction and putting in more definitions. And as I said before, the work group thought it would be better to leave the definitions to federal law and keep those same terms so that they would march along the same path. Those are the highlights of the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Bob Juneff is sitting next to me, and he worked on this work group with us, with the Law Commission, as well as the Bureau of Labor and Industries and attorneys from that represent business as well as plaintiffs.
Thank you. Would you like to testify, sir?
Thank you.
Yes, please do.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Juneff. I'm from the Oregon Advocacy Center, and I'm speaking on behalf of the center today, although I did sit on the Civil Rights Work Group for the last 4 years and working on making clarifications and reorganizing our civil rights laws. Wendy's done a good job in going over the details of the bill. I want to address my comments specifically to the amendments as I understand them. From the Advocacy Center's point of view, the amendments are really a matter of form rather than substance, in that the bill as it was originally written laid out a number of details in terms of what some of the terms mean in such as auxiliary aids and services, readily achievable, and some other terminology. There was a sense that because it's very difficult to bring the exact definitions of the federal law over into the state law, that they might not be exactly the same. And representatives of business interests and said, you know, we would be more comfortable if these standards were the same. We want to have one standard that we can understand that we need to abide with. And the way that we came about to deal with that was to write in something that said, here's the general standard. Bollier is empowered to write rules that will track as closely as possible with the federal laws as it can, and then it can adjust as it goes along, because as you know, the federal law continues to be the subject of interpretation. For one reason or another, there was concern on some senators' side that this gave too much power to Bollier, as I understood the argument, and that those senators would be more comfortable with a set standard in state law that was set by the Oregon legislature. And that's really what is reflected in the -3 amendments. Again, from a disability advocacy point of view, it really doesn't matter one way or the other. I think the basic concepts are covered in both the Ayn Gross bill and in the -3 amendments. It's really a matter of form. And so, again, we would support the bill in either form.
Fine. Thank you for your testimony. Do we have questions of this panel from the committee? Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, maybe I can address this to Mr. Jindiff. Where I read this bill, if barrier removal is not readily achievable, the place of accommodation shall take alternative steps. And then there are listed, let's see, five of them. Provide goods and services, the door, sidewalk, or curb, provide home delivery, retrieving merchandise from inaccessible shelves or racks, relocating activities to accessible locations, or relaxing administrative policies. To either one of you, this question would be, let's say that someone is disabled, and is the store required to make a home delivery free of charge to that person, or can they take other alternative means of accommodating that person?
Mr. Chair, Council Taylor, no, they wouldn't be specifically required to do that. What the law calls for is for a solution to the accessibility problem that is most effective, and it doesn't require that any specific activity be taken. So, for example, in the case of a business, if a business makes itself available to people to come and get services, and the business is not accessible, let's say they don't have a ramp, let's say the person's in a wheelchair and they would need a ramp in order to access that business, but the business can't afford to put in a ramp, then the business needs to take the step that would be the most similar, which in that type of example would be bringing the goods out in front of the store so that the person who comes to the store would be able to access them. There's nothing in the ADA that I'm aware of that would require extraordinary services to be provided to a person with disabilities. Really what the law is intended to do is to allow a person to avail themselves of the same service or as close to it as possible.
Chair, one follow-up question. So, Mr. Jindal, if a person is in a wheelchair, they could not call up the store and demand that milk be delivered to their house.
Mr. Chair, Council Taylor, I am unaware of any case that's ever interpreted the ADA or state law to do that.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Taylor, just to add, page 20 of the federal law handout that I provided you, It details this almost verbatim, the exact same list, and to my knowledge, federal law has not required the delivery of the gallon of milk either.
Further questions from the committee? Could you just give us an idea of the extent of this problem in the public? How would you assess the need for these changes based upon current market situation, market trends? Did you have any studies or any testimony from either the disabled community or the business community as to how well we're doing with what we have?
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, perhaps an answer to your question is what happens if we don't pass the bill? The issue will probably be continued to be litigated on what Oregon statute really does mean. But as I said at the beginning, federal law already requires the standard of providing an accommodation to disabled persons. So it's not like we're changing the law in this area. It's already required of all businesses in Oregon if there are places of public accommodation as required by federal law. So it won't change. It will just make it clearer to a business who opens the statute and looks at the very general statute presently that doesn't detail the kind of requirements that are required by federal law and arguably by state law. You have to go to the administrative rules now to see what the accommodation requirements are. So it's not business friendly in that sense. There's not guidance. But we don't think practice would change either way if the bill doesn't pass, because federal law does require these accommodations.
I guess my point is I would like to hear from the persons in the disabled community as to their experiences and their problems, of trying to assess what the need is. I'm sure there is, but those of us that aren't in that community don't know these things, and I'm wondering if you have any information on that based upon your work on this bill.
Mr. Chair, our office represents people with disabilities who have problems in terms of accessing businesses. I would say that one of the reasons that this bill, I think, is coming to you in the manner it is that it's really is a law reform type of approach in order to try to make, to clarify what the state law says, because we have been, Oregon has been ruled by the federal law in this area for almost 15 years. One of the things that's a little bit different than the employment area, for example, is that this law applies to all businesses, regardless of size. So it's something that we've lived with in all areas for some time. In terms of the impact, I can just tell you from the perspective of our office is that Oregonians have been, from our perspective, been surprisingly non-litigative in this area. It isn't a big area of concern that comes to our office. However, one of the aspects of the way that the law is presently structured is that if there is a problem, turning it into a federal case is a much bigger deal, obviously. The taking a problem to a federal agency for enforcement or taking it into the federal courts is a big undertaking and takes a long time. Using a state mechanism through BOLI can be a much more effective way to resolve a problem for a person. It moves more quickly. BOLI is structured in order to seek resolution without having to resort to legal remedies, and so just from a what I would say is a way that a person can resolve their own problem without going to a lawyer, without taking an enormous amount of time and making a federal case out of it, having access to BOLI, I think is a very positive thing. And so we see the state laws having an important role in terms of allowing people to resolve their problems in the least adversarial, if you will, way, in a way that can be resolved quickly and hopefully by administrative resolution or negotiation rather than ending up in federal court.
Thank you. We have another witness up here. Would you like to identify yourself? You're right on time to testify.
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Marcia Oley Miller. I'm the legal policy advisor for the Bureau of Labor and Industries, and I apologize for arriving late, and also I was sitting there listening to the discussion to determine, excuse me, whether I could really add anything. And I think Mr. Jundeff actually just said what I came up here to say, which is you may be wondering if this is already covered in federal law, why should Oregon adopt it? The remedies or the ways to address the problem are the real reason, because as Mr. Jundeff said, if a disabled person tried to get access to a place of public accommodation in Oregon and wasn't successful, unless it was outright discrimination, if all they wanted was an accommodation, the remedies under federal law would be to either initiate a federal lawsuit or go to the U.S. Department of Justice, which only really takes impact cases. If there's something of interest to them, like a whole string of movie theaters across the country or a whole string of grocery stores across the country, then they'll look at the case. But if it's one individual trying to get access to one place of business, they don't really take those cases forward. They don't have an administrative process for those. The Bureau of Labor and Industries, of course, does. That's what we do the most of, is take administrative complaints and really attempt to resolve them. They may go forward to a contested case hearing or even to court sometimes, but we try to resolve them at the level of what can be done to get these parties to a place where the complainant is getting what it is they're seeking. And so I think that's the big upside of Oregon clarifying that, yes, our disability public accommodation law does require accommodation of the person, is that gives the latitude to complainants to go forward and come to the Bureau of Labor and Industries, or if they did take that kind of case to court, the court would know that Oregon law does require that. So I think that, to me, is a major point that is important to understand. Aside from that, as far as the rule writing piece, BOLI already has the authority in Chapter 659A to write rules for all of Chapter 659A. So the specific language that was put into this bill, as they explained during the process, the bill started out with all of the same amount of detail in it that you see in the Dash 3 amendments. But the work group really felt like that took the flexibility out of rulemaking, because these are very detailed definitions. And what if federal law would change? What if the ADA would change? And then BOLI's hands would be tied from changing our own rules to be consistent with that. And so it was really the decision of the work group that the rulemaking should be available in as flexible a form as possible to adapt Oregon's rules to track the ADA rules, and that even better, how about a provision in there saying that Oregon's rules shall track the ADA rules, which would make it even more clear and would also point and also draw to the attention of courts the fact that the Bureau does have rules in this area, which has been, I think, an issue. Sometimes maybe some of them weren't even aware that we had rules. So those are the things that the rulemaking reference was intended to address, and as well taking out all these details. The Bureau can live with it either way, but we do recognize the usefulness of having some flexibility in changing our rules should the federal standards change. And I also think that would benefit the business community as well, because the way that this amendment stands, these things would literally be written into law and could not be changed until the next legislative session should the federal standard change. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, hearing none. Thank you very much for your participation this morning. I have two more witnesses, Dan Floyd and Julie Brandes. Would you like to come forward? And any others? Morning, and proceed any way you wish.
Okay.
Okay.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, my name is Dan Floyd. I represent the Oregon Grocery Association. We have 235 members that operate in 1,100 member locations in the state, and they employ over 50,000 Oregonians. Today, I'm here, obviously, in opposition to Senate Bill 235. I have 3 points I'd like to make. I'll make them briefly. The first is that we have yet to identify among our members anybody who is not in compliance right now, and anybody who is not doing what this bill is intended to do, which is provide goods and services to disabled persons. We provide goods and services to all of our customers equally, and we do have employees on staff, on site, who are there to assist people in the shopping experience and make sure everyone has the same rights, privileges to attain the goods and services that they are there to obtain. Now, the second thing, I want to look at the second page of the bill. The bill makes suggestions as to ways that we can accommodate our customers. And as I explained, we are doing that right now. However, the list of suggestions here are exactly what we are doing. Right, like I said, there are employees there that will assist the disabled persons or any customer, whether the good is too high on a shelf, too low on a shelf, or just simply not accessible at that time. They're there to make sure that everything is accessible to them. They provide service at the check stand. They also provide service out to the curb or out to the car. So there is carry out for people who cannot access goods there at the check stand or cannot bag their own groceries. Finally, as we've already discussed, we're not required or mandated to provide all of these services. So there are some stores who provide home delivery, some that do not. The stores that do provide home delivery provide this service to all their customers equally. There's not an additional fee or cost for being disabled, so they're not discriminating against a disabled person for requiring home delivery. Finally, this hasn't been identified. If I have missed this, I apologize, but this bill attempts to move the authority from the federal government to the state government, to BOLI. So this is additional enforcement, additional oversight, additional authority. And I don't even think I heard the question that we haven't identified what that can mean financially for our state. I don't know if it's a tremendous amount, but we haven't even addressed that. So because of those reasons, we oppose Senate Bill 235.
Thank you. Brandes?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries and its Retail Council. I think it's important to note that in the ADA, that current regulations do impose affirmative obligation to remove barriers and to create access for those who are disabled. And I think Mr. Floyd did a great job of explaining how retailers actually do comply, not only in cases of the ADA, but if you're vertically challenged, such as I am. I've never had a problem getting anything down from a top shelf or something such as that. Also, if you look at some of our warehouse stores, many of the products are stacked awfully high. They're very heavy, and it's the store's responsibility for many reasons to accommodate all customers. I think it's important to talk about, I don't know much about the Law Commission, and I apologize for that. And I am not sure who the lawyers were who were representing the business community at that time. But it might be helpful for all of us to sit down with more of the associations that actually have to explain these laws to companies as opposed to just lawyers representing certain clients. And I think that would help alleviate some of these some of the issues that we're having today with the with this law. This proposal. And I think finally, it's important to note that sometimes federal law does exceed state law, and sometimes state law does exceed federal law. And a perfect example is Oregon's family leave law is stronger and is broader than family leave law, and that sometimes causes, than this federal family leave law, excuse me. And I think that sometimes causes great conflict internally with our companies, and we have never seen Bowley willing to help us, proactively address that issue. So, again, we always find it better just to follow one set of standards, and we have those in the federal law.
Thank you. Questions of the panel from the committee? Okay, seeing none, excuse. Any further witnesses on Senate Bill 235? Please come forward. Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 235A. I have two work session items. I think I'd like to proceed as long as I have a quorum at the forum, okay? I have continued the work session on Senate Bill 229A, so we'll take that up. Is there a motion? And the chair will move that SB 229A be forwarded to the full committee with the due counsel recommendation. Discussion? Objections? Clerk may call the roll.
Representative Morris?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
I thought he was here. I'm sorry. Okay, let's continue and see what we get.
Representative Worth?
Aye.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye. What's the vote count?
3-0.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senate Bill 229A is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I will carry it to the committee. And with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 229A. And I probably should wait for how long will.
Let me go get him. See what he's at.
Yeah. Will this be in.
You did?
Yep.
Okay.
Oh. Do we have an idea when he's coming back?
No, I think he's just going to be back.
All right, well.
He's pretty quick.
I'll go hunt him down.
Yeah, see, we'll just stand at ease for a couple of minutes and see if we get our quorum back. That time of year. Thank you. think what I'll do is just, we have a short bill, Senate Bill 236. And we're only proceeding on a public hearing on that, so I'll open the public hearing on Senate Bill 236, since it looks like it's fairly quick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 236 comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, clarifies that a civil action for discrimination in places of public accommodation or a civil action for aiding and abetting discrimination in a place of public accommodation must be commenced with 1 year of the occurrence of the unlawful practice. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I remember correctly, the testimony on the Senate side was that for some reason the current statute did not contain a statute of limitations, and this is what this bill would do.
Ms. Johnson, would you like to come forward, please?
Thank you, Chair Ackerman, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. Council has summarized the bill accurately. There was no statute of limitations. Claimants have a choice of filing with BOLI or in court. There was no court statute of limitations. Putting 1 year in is generally the standard for such claims regarding discrimination, and so the work group opted for 1 year. Cuts down on malpractice, is easy for business to follow. It's a good bill.
Fine. Happy to answer your questions. Thank you very much for your testimony. Other questions? Okay, seeing none, appreciate your participation and your testimony. Further witnesses on Senate Bill 236. Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 236. I'll proceed then and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 239. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 239A comes to you from the Oregon Law Commission, and it creates consistency throughout Oregon's anti-discrimination laws concerning who is protected under the law.
Witnesses, please come forward.
Thank you, Chair Ackerman. Again, for the record, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director, Oregon Law Commission. This is the last Law Commission bill of the day, so I thank you for your patience. This bill, you should have before you a report explaining the bill, Senate Bill 239, and I also provided you with a chart that lists section by section which class is added to the bill. As most of you know, the ADA and other federal law, as well as state law, prohibits discrimination based on race, religion, sex, marital status, those type of things, but each time the list is different in our statute because of when the statute was enacted. And so this bill just cleans up the order and adds in an omitted class. And the chart explains which class we added in each section. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Other questions for the committee of Ms. Johnson? Okay, seeing none, on your excuse. Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Any further witnesses on this bill? Senate Bill 239, please come forward. Seeing none, then I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 239. And the work session on Senate Bill 229 has been continued, and we'll proceed with that at this time.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Would you like a motion?
Excuse me?
Would you like a motion?
Can we just do that?
I thought we kept the work session open on...
No, we did that.
We did that one.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, you were gone.
Yeah. You already did 229.
Three zips, so we got it out.
Okay.
Thank you for the correction. Then I'll open the work session on House Bill 2285.
Chair Ackerman, members of the committee, House Bill 2285 has been before you before. This is the bill that requires the health professional regulatory boards to disclose information obtained by the boards in investigation of disciplinary actions of licensees. You have before you dash six amendments. These amendments further clarify which records that the boards may withhold. Previously there was discussion on the dash four amendments. Those amendments provide that boards may withhold information regarding the identity of the person that made the complaint. The dash six amendments go further in describing what information the boards may withhold in order to make it so that licensees cannot identify who the complainant was, and that to ensure that licensees cannot get information from the boards for individuals who made complaints or who were interviewed but are not going to testify at the hearing. This Dash 6 Amendment also provides that a licensee may only disclose information received from the boards to the extent necessary to prepare for the hearing, so there's some limitations on what the licensee may do in order to ensure that that information is not further disseminated. Again, this is these are the Dash 6 Amendments, and there's nothing further on those.
Okay. This still just provides to the healthcare agencies, Council?
Yes.
Okay. And only applies in perhaps licensing issues, license revocation proceedings, or suspension proceedings?
Yes, disciplinary proceedings.
Okay. And what we tried to do by the Dash 6 is to more quantify the type of information which would not be produced to the applicant or to the licensee?
That's correct.
Okay. Is there a discussion? I'll put the motion on the table. The chair will move that the Dash 6 amendments be incorporated within the main bill, House Bill 2285. Discussion. Objections. Hearing none, the Dash 6s are incorporated within House Bill 2285. Chair will move that House Bill 2285 be forwarded as amended to the full committee with a due pass recommendation. Now is our discussion.
Mr. Chair,
yes,
I maintain my no on this basically for the same reason I have all along. So just wanted to let you know.
Thank you for your comment. Further discussion from the committee? Hearing none, then the clerk can call the roll.
Representative Floyd?
Aye.
Representative Gerard?
No.
Representative Worth?
Yes.
Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
House Bill 2285 is amended, is forwarded to the full committee with a due pass recommendation, and I will be the carrier to the full committee. Work session is concluded on House Bill 2285. Is there further business to come before the committee? Seeing none. Thank you for your participation. We're adjourned.